Welcome to the debate. So if you walk into, you know, a modern intensive care unit today, you are essentially witnessing the absolute pinnacle of human capability.
Oh, absolutely. It's almost science fiction.
Right? I mean, you have a specialist monitoring the exact rhythm of the heart. You have a completely different expert balancing renal function. And you have all these machines tracking blood oxygen down to the decimal point.
Yeah.
Every single subsystem is perfectly, beautifully optimized to do exactly what it was designed to do.
Right. And it really is a triumph of specialization. We essentially compartmentalize to conquer complexity.
Exactly.
We divide the body into these discrete, manageable systems so we can understand them and, you know, manipulate them with incredible precision.
But then you zoom out. You realize the patient is breathing heavily polluted air the very moment they walk out the hospital doors.
Yeah, or they can't even afford the medication the specialist just prescribed.
Exactly. Or the hospital itself is running on this massive carbon footprint that is literally warming the planet. And the cardiologist, the nephrologist, the hospital administrator, they can all legitimately report total 100% success in their specific departments.
But the overall patient and the environment they actually live in are deteriorating.
Right. We have these brilliant, highly optimized fragments, but we are completely missing the whole. And that paradox, that exact tension, is at the heart of Bechara Sahali's 2026 foundational paper, The Missing Grammar of Modern Civilization.
Yeah, it's such a dense but important text.
It really is. So Sahali argues that modern civilization operates on something sociologists call functional differentiation.
Right. And just to unpack that term for a moment for the discussion, functional differentiation is essentially the way modern society separates itself into these highly specialized domains, you know, science, medicine, law, economics.
Mm-hmm.
Each domain has its own distinct language, its own internal metrics for success, and its own strict boundaries. And Sahali's core premise here is that this very separation creates a profound deficit.
A massive one, yeah.
Because these systems excel in isolation, right? But they fail catastrophically when they have to interact at the interfaces. They end up producing these systemic cross-domain crises like climate change or health inequity, where responsibility is just entirely fragmented.
Which brings us to the exact question we are debating today. Sahali proposes a framework he calls civilizational healing. He suggests this can successfully serve as an integrative grammar, you know, a way to connect our fragmented institutions.
And that is a very loaded proposition.
It is. So the central question is whether this framework can actually bridge our specialized silos without just turning into centralized tyranny, or if the very concept of healing a civilization inevitably invites totalization, paternalism, and the dangerous misapplication of medical metaphors to complex political realities.
Right.
So to lay our cards on the table, I argue that civilizational healing is a strictly necessary, carefully safeguarded syntax for reflexive integration that can bridge our specialized silos without centralized tyranny.
And I contend that despite all the theoretical safeguards Sahali writes in, treating a civilization like a patient relies on a historically dangerous metaphor that risks normalization, social engineering, and profound ideological capture.
Okay, so let me start by laying out why this framework is so vital. I mean, we have to acknowledge the absolute brilliance of modernity's functional differentiation. It wasn't a mistake.
No, it was a breakthrough.
Right. Separating legal validity from moral virtue, or separating scientific truth from, say, political popularity, that generated immense human progress. A scientific claim isn't accepted just because a king likes it.
Right.
And a court doesn't decide a case just by measuring aggregate happiness. This differentiation protects the absolute integrity of these distinct practices.
Yeah. I mean, it stops the church from dictating physics, and it stops the state from just dictating the law based on whim.
Exactly. But it results in what the sociologist Ulrich Beck so perfectly called organized irresponsibility.
Organized irresponsibility. Yeah.
Right. A hospital meets its throughput targets. It looks great on paper, but it inadvertently reproduces local racial inequities. Or a new automated tech platform scales profitably. It complies with every single existing law, but it completely undermines the local ecology and democratic attention spans.
Because everyone is just looking at their own dashboard.
Exactly. Every subsystem reports success in its own language, while the larger pattern becomes entirely life-disabling. So civilizational healing is not meant to be like a master theory or a super discipline that comes in to rule the law or overrule the economy.
Okay, but then what is it, practically?
It is a translation grammar. It's a semantic architecture designed to connect evidence of injury, mechanism, power, and responsibility across these isolated silos. It takes concepts like planetary boundaries or One Health from being just academic overlaps, and it turns them into structures of functional mutual answerability.
Look, I'll give Sal Haley this much. His diagnosis of organized irresponsibility is spot on. I mean, we've all seen this interface problem.
It's everywhere.
It really is. Carbon emissions can indeed be economically profitable. They can be legally permitted, technically incredibly efficient, and ecologically devastating all at the exact same time. The problem is very real.
But
treating this like a medical patient, treating the entire civilization like it needs a doctor, that's where he completely loses me. Because we have to look at the dark historical evidence of what actually happens when we use organismic images to define political order.
You're talking about the history of seeing the state as a literal body.
Yes. Treating society as a physical organism naturally, almost inevitably, creates a hierarchy. Think about it. A head rules, the limbs just blindly obey, and most dangerously, the whole takes priority over the so-called expendable parts.
Well, but Siley isn't...
Let me just bring up the extreme end of this, because we saw it in the eugenics movements of the 19th and 20th centuries. I mean, look at the U.S. Supreme Court case, Buck versus Bell, in 1927.
Oh yeah, that is a dark one.
It's horrifying. The court justified the forced sterilization of a young woman, Carrie Buck, by explicitly claiming it was a contribution to the public welfare. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously and brutally wrote that it was better for all the world to prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind rather than waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or letting them starve.
Right.
When society is imagined as a biological patient that needs to be kept healthy, targeted populations inevitably become pathogens. They become defective tissue or burdens to be excised for the quote-unquote health of the whole.
Okay, that is a horrific history, and honestly, Saheli does not shy away from it in the text. But we have to be really clear about how this framework actively prevents that kind of fatalism. Saheli explicitly rejects an organismic ontology.
He says he does, yes.
No, he builds it into the structure. He doesn't think society is literally a physical body where you can just amputate a sick limb. He offers the analogy of an ecosystem instead. Civilization is a historically extended socio-ecological order, not a single organism with expendable parts.
But the word he insists on using is healing. And healing inherently, by definition, carries a clinical asymmetry.
How so?
Well, a healer possesses expert knowledge and the patient just passively submits to the cure. When you project that dynamic onto politics, you get severe paternalism. Experts simplify incredibly complex local human realities into neat administrative categories and impose these large-scale high modernist schemes.
But it's not about imposing a cure from above.
But healing language inherently depoliticizes conflict. That's what it does. It recodes legitimate political demands for justice or for structural change as emotional wounds that just need to be smoothed over. You know, the harmed are asked to just heal and move on and release their anger, while the actual structures that produce the harm remain completely intact.
Okay, but you're missing the core mechanism here, which Saheli calls post-totalizing normativity.
Right, a very dense term.
It sounds dense, yeah, but it essentially means the framework is extremely thick and strict at the baselines and entirely pluralistic everywhere else.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning it demands a rights floor, like basic human dignity and anti-domination are strictly non-negotiable. And it demands an ecological ceiling, meaning we simply cannot breach planetary boundaries. But between that floor and that ceiling, it is entirely pluralistic in its definitions of human flourishing.
So it doesn't define what a healthy society looks like in the middle?
Exactly. Drawing on philosophers of science, you know, like George Kengleham and Michel Foucault, the framework explicitly states that anomaly is not injury. That is huge. Disability, neurodivergence, political dissent, these are not pathologies to be cured under this grammar. The framework requires rigorous, democratic, and epistemic procedure where the affected communities have actual standing, not just token consultation.
Honestly, if you're listening to this and thinking, wow, that sounds like a massive amount of theoretical duct tape, you're not alone.
It's not duct tape, it's structural safeguards.
But if a framework requires five immensely complex layers of constitutional safeguards just to prevent its core metaphor from sliding back into eugenics or high modernist social engineering, isn't it just fundamentally the wrong grammar entirely?
I don't think so.
If the word healing constantly threatens to become a weapon of normalization, why not use a vocabulary grounded in justice, equity, or rights? Those concepts don't carry this inherent dangerous biological fatalism.
Because rights language alone simply doesn't capture the relational and ecological mechanisms at play anymore.
How does it not?
Well, rights language is fantastic at translating a direct, linear injury into standing and jurisdiction. If I punch you, or, you know, if I steal your property, rights language handles that perfectly.
Right.
But it completely, utterly misses cumulative, transboundary, or intergenerational injuries that escape traditional legal causation. How does rights language handle a chemical that takes 40 years to affect a watershed, and it's driven by the complex interactions of a dozen different industries?
Okay, that is a fair point about the limits of legal causation.
The healing grammar is what connects those normative rights to the actual material and ecological conditions of life.
Okay, then let's actually walk through how this functions materially. Because the high theory is one thing, but how does this play out when the rubber actually hits the road?
All right, let's use Saley's own example from the text of a bounded healing episode regarding heat-related mortality in a major city. This illustrates how we actually overcome fragmentation without needing a sovereign center or a dictator.
Okay, lay it out.
Right now, if a massive heat wave hits, the hospital just treats the heat stroke cases. The energy company just tries to keep the grid from collapsing, and urban planning maybe looks at long-term zoning for trees. They do not talk to each other.
Right. Functional differentiation at work.
Exactly. Under this framework, you use polycentric boundary institutions. This might look like a joint task force, but with real enforceable mandate power. So the hospital tracks the specific zip codes of heat stroke victims.
Mm-hmm.
Then the boundary institution translates that exact health data into a financial risk metric for the real estate developers and an infrastructure metric for the energy grid. It literally forces the different systems to translate their goals and track their cross-domain consequences. They hold each other accountable through portfolios of protection, repair, and transformation.
Okay, I hear you. But let's really look at the mechanics of this integration using Nicholas Luhmann's systems theory, which, as you know, Saheli himself cites.
Yes, he draws on Luhmann a lot.
Luhmann showed that a functionally differentiated society has no Archimedean point. There was no master lever, no omniscient control room from which one subsystem can just steer the whole.
Which Saheli agrees with.
Right, but economic systems selectively rationalize purely for profit. They only speak the language of money. Legal systems rationalize for validity, right? They only speak the language of legal versus illegal.
Right. They are what Luhmann calls operationally closed.
Exactly. They are closed. So how exactly does a boundary institution force a multinational financial entity or a massive logistics company to suddenly prioritize life capacities without exercising coercive, centralized state power?
It's about structural friction.
But you can show a logistics company that their supply chain creates respiratory illness in a specific zip code. I mean, you can give them all the beautifully translated data in the world, but their internal metric is still quarterly yield. Observation does not equal subordination.
It does it by creating mutual answerability. The boundary institution isn't a sovereign council dictating terms from on high. It's a structural interface that forces those economic decisions to become observable in health and ecological terms. And that visibility then triggers regulatory, legal, or social friction if they don't adapt.
But the very moment you try to measure that, the moment you put it on a dashboard, you run face first into Campbell's Law.
Ah, Campbell's Law.
Yes. Campbell's law tells us that the more any quantitative social indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
Sure. People game the system.
Exactly. If you introduce a civilizational health index across these systems, the institutions will just optimize for the metric rather than the underlying purpose. Without a centralized coercive mechanism to strictly enforce these boundaries, polycentric governance just becomes a forum for the most powerful subsystem, which is almost always economics, to dictate terms and game the metrics.
And that is precisely why the framework explicitly rejects a single civilizational score. There is no one health index. Campbell's law is a known, acknowledged threat, which is exactly why the integration is designed to be reflexive.
Reflexive meaning it checks itself.
Yes, it constantly questions its own metrics. It relies on a dashboard of contestable questions, and it preserves qualitative lived testimony right alongside the quantitative data. But to your broader point about how we actually process and translate all of this without just being totally overwhelmed by the sheer complexity, this is where artificial intelligence enters as the historical hinge.
Oh, here we go. AI as the great synthesizer.
Not a savior, just an infrastructure. Look, we are dealing with a level of complexity that simply exceeds human cognitive limits. No human committee, no matter how smart, can track the interaction between global supply chains, local health outcomes, and microecological shifts in real time.
I don't disagree with the complexity issue.
It has the capacity for cross-domain synthesis. It can read fundamentally incompatible literatures in law, ecology, and medicine, and translate across them. It can build anticipatory models to simulate futures and track displaced burdens at a scale previously impossible.
In theory?
It moves us from mere system intelligence, which is just single-loop goal correction, like optimizing a single supply chain, to true civilizational intelligence. It allows us to map causal mechanisms across the entire board and, crucially, maintain institutional memory.
Okay, let's really unpack the reality of that. Because the text itself warns that AI currently functions almost entirely as an amplifier of subsystem optimization.
Currently, yes.
It doesn't solve fragmentation right now, it accelerates it. Look at the Obermeyer algorithmic bias example cited in the paper. This is so crucial. We had a widely used health management algorithm in the United States that was designed to identify which patients needed extra medical care.
Right, I remember this.
The ultimate goal was health, but the algorithm couldn't measure quote-unquote health directly, so it used healthcare costs as a proxy. It assumed, quite simply, that the people who cost the most to treat were the sickest.
Which, to be fair, makes logical sense within a purely economic, siloed worldview.
Right. But because of deep structural inequalities and historical systemic racism, historically, less money is spent on Black patients compared to white patients with the exact same level of medical need.
Yeah.
So this algorithm, which was supposedly objective and supposedly synthesizing data, systematically underestimated the health needs of Black patients. It scaled racial bias at an unprecedented speed, affecting millions and millions of people. It optimized perfectly for its proxy cost while failing completely at its actual purpose, which was health.
It was a disaster, yes.
That is a massive proxy failure. So how can we possibly trust AI to manage a civilizational grammar when it operates by collapsing complex, messy human realities into simplistic, optimizable variables?
But see, the Obermeyer example actually proves the necessity of the healing grammar rather than refuting it.
How does it prove it?
Because the failure there wasn't the technology itself. It was a category error embedded in the institution that deployed it. Cost silently replaced health, and nobody caught it until the damage was already done at scale.
Exactly.
But Saheli's framework demands that legitimate public purpose precedes the optimization. Under civilizational healing, AI is governed specifically to expose those exact proxy failures. It isn't used for authority laundering, where we just, you know, trust the machine because it's a fancy machine.
But that's what happens in the real world.
But under this framework, it's used for causal contestation and red teaming. It models the system specifically to find where the burdens are being displaced.
Okay, but even if we assume, and that is a massive if, that the software can be governed, look at the material hardware. Look at the sheer physical reality of AI.
The energy use?
Yes. AI operates with an immense, staggering material metabolism. The International Energy Agency projects that global data center electricity use could double by 2030, driven largely by AI processing.
It is very resource intensive.
It requires vast amounts of water for cooling. It requires conflict minerals for hardware and deeply precarious labor for data annotation. How can we trust AI to act as a reflexive, quote unquote, healing infrastructure when its very deployment currently displaces massive ecological and social burdens onto vulnerable communities?
I hear you.
It directly violates the framework's own non-displacement principle. It is literally sickening the ecosystem to supposedly heal the civilization.
But it only violates that principle if it remains ungoverned, which is the exact status quo Saheli is trying to fix. That is exactly why the framework insists AI's material and social metabolism must be entirely visible on the dashboard.
Visibility isn't regulation, though.
It requires stop rules and decommissioning protocols designed in advance. Look, the AI cannot be the healer, the machine cannot grant political legitimacy, it cannot recognize moral standing, and it cannot accept responsibility. Those are strictly non-delegable human tasks.
I certainly hope so.
The AI is simply the scaffolding. It's the scaffolding that allows human communities to observe the complex interactions of their siloed systems. Without that scaffolding, we are just completely blind to the systemic effects of our own complexity.
I remain highly skeptical that heavily optimized AI systems, which, let's be real, are currently owned largely by concentrated corporate monopolies, will voluntarily subordinate their immense efficiency to pluralistic, life-grounded evaluation without centralized coercion.
It's a huge hurdle, I agree.
And the moment you attempt to impose that level of coercion to force them to care about the whole, you run right back into the totalizing dangers of the high modernist state that we started this entire conversation trying to avoid.
Look, we have to choose between two profound risks here. The risks you are pointing out, the dangers of the healing metaphor, the very real threat of paternalism, the immense material footprint of AI, they are entirely real. I am not dismissing them.
They are existential.
But the dangers of remaining in our siloed, functionally differentiated status quo are definitively worse. If we do nothing, if we just keep operating in our separate lanes, the interface failures will simply compound until the ecological and social foundations of our civilization completely collapse.
The status quo is definitely failing.
Right. Civilizational healing provides a rigorous, necessary syntax to hold fragmented institutions accountable to the actual conditions of life. It leverages AI not to rule us, but as a vital tool for public memory and consequence tracking.
Well, I will concede this much. Modernity's missing grammar is a profound and incredibly urgent diagnosis. The interface failures between our systems are absolutely our greatest existential threat right now.
Yes.
But adopting a historically violent metaphor to solve it is a trap. The language of healing inherently pathologizes difference and empowers experts to bypass democratic friction in the name of a cure. And relying on polycentric boundary institutions guided by heavily metabolized AI systems, it just seems much more likely to create a highly efficient, high-tech veneer of wellness while the underlying extraction continues unabated.
Which brings us to the ultimate warning of the text, an area where I believe our perspectives actually converge.
Oh.
Yeah, we must fundamentally abandon the dangerous, totalizing horizon of a permanently healthy civilization.
Yes, absolutely. A permanently healthy civilization is a terrifying, almost fascist concept.
Completely.
It treats conflict, tragedy, and irreversible loss just as defects to be cured, usually through suppression or excision of whoever is causing the friction.
Exactly. A perfectly healthy civilization is a static, tyrannical one. Instead, Saheli argues we must strive for a civilization capable of healing.
Which is a very different thing.
Exactly. One that maintains the epistemic humility to actually hear refusal, the institutional memory to track displaced burdens, and the capacity to recursively revise its own rules when it inevitably fails.
It's really about maintaining answerability to reality, right? Even when that reality is deeply uncomfortable or resists neat categorization.
Precisely. If we return to that intensive care unit we started with, we don't need to destroy the specialized machines, and we certainly don't want to fire the experts.
We don't want to lose the incredible gains of functional differentiation.
No, we need that expertise.
We just need to remember that the patient is a complex human being who has to walk out the door, back into a community, and breathe the air. And we leave it to you, the listener, to decide if our modern institutions have the will to adopt this new grammar, or if we will just continue to perfectly optimize our individual systems while the whole collapses around us.